The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is for Master Dogen's 300 koan Shobogenzo. Case 10, Chingwan's Come Closer, the main case. Once a student asked Master Chingwan, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India?" Chingwan said, "It's just like this." The student asked further, "What do you have to teach these days?" Chingwan said, "Come closer." The student moved closer. Chingwan said, "Keep this in mind." The commentary. The great way has no side roads. Those who walk it have all settled the true imperative. The truth is not in seeing or hearing, nor can it be found in words and ideas. When you've passed through the forest of brambles and have untied the chains of Buddha and Dharma, only then will you have entered the peaceful dwelling. In bringing it out for this student, Chingwan is still dripping with water, covered in mud. But alas, the student couldn't get it. How awkward. Be that as it may, if you yourself can see into Chingwan's truth and see that the nature of coming and going is not a matter of understanding, then the compassionate effort will not have been in vain after all. The verse. The bright shining sun lights up the sky. The pure whispering wind covers the earth. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, those of you at home. I was just remembering how Dada Roshi, when he was working over quite a number of years on giving talks on all of these koans, these were a collection of koans that Master Dogen brought back from China when he traveled to China in search of a true teacher, found Yuching, studied with him, received, had a deep enlightenment experience, received the transmission, came back to Japan, and he brought these with him and used them to sort of as seeds for his Shobogenzo masterwork. And so over many years, Dada Roshi gave talks, and that's what this is drawn from, these commentaries and verses. And I remember after many years, at one point, he said that he was coming towards the end of the collection and that he was coming to the koans that he wasn't that interested in, or he didn't think were that great koans, but he had to get through them because they were part of the collection. And I kind of think that this is one of those. It's not a great koan, as koans go, in terms of, it is not without merit. And so we'll see what we can bring forth from it. So during the Bodhidharma Session, I gave a couple talks that really was just drawing from this question, and I talked a bit about that, this what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West, from India, which is a question that students pose over and over and over again to teachers. It shows up in many koans and many dialogues. And so, and I talked at some length about the question and how the student needs to work with it, so I won't do that today. But here it is again. And so this student asked Master Chingwan, who was had studied with Huainong. So this is very early in the Zen tradition, Huainong being the sixth ancestor. So this is 7th, early 8th century. And he studied with Huainong, but Huainong died. And so he went he did receive the transmission from Huainong and then taught Shido, who is the next ancestor. But at any rate, this is early on in the Zen tradition. And so here is this question again. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India? And in the commentary, Dada Roshi begins by saying, the Great Way has no side roads. And I mentioned last night, I think, that you know, in all of these teachings and practices and practice traditions that come down to us, that you know, in the evolution of Buddhism, you know, there are all kinds of forces that were being met and were influencing the evolution of Buddhism in the sense of how it was evolving in practice centers and monasteries, how the teachings were evolving, what needs it was needing to meet, and what influences were pressing against it, and so on. But throughout, the most important thing has always been the liberating of our minds from suffering, from the false view of self, from false views, to free us of our attachments. The Buddha's essential question from the very beginning is recognizing that life is dukkha, there is suffering. There are all of these ways in which we, even in the best of circumstances, living like gods, there is all kinds of subtle and not so subtle forms of distress and sorrow and anguish and tension and pain and conflict. And yet we have these rather brilliant minds. So we're alive here, we know that. Everything is impermanent. I hope we all know that. And the poisons, greed, anger, delusion, jealousy, and pride, are all in ample display all around us. And that's always been true. Always. So how do we find our way? How do we find our way in? The Great Way has no side roads. The Great Way is not difficult. You're never apart from it, even as you stand on it. It never lacks. It's never in excess. All these different ways of talking about something essential, something fundamental that we speak of as the Great Way, that we speak of as our self-nature, as Buddha nature. But if that's true, if it is our self-nature, if we're never apart from it, if nothing we could do can diminish it or extinguish it, then why is there so much difficulty, right? It seems to be one of the essential questions that every religious or spiritual tradition needs to deal with. Are we just inherently kind of, you know, messed up? Or is there something else going on? Well, the Buddha had very profound insight into that. If all of us want to live and have happiness, and then why does it take so much effort to not create harm, to practice good, to actualize good for others? These seemingly very simple, easy to understand. So Dada Roshi says, the truth is not in seeing or hearing. It can't be found in words and ideas. If it could, we would have settled this a long time ago. Every single person could settle it. The fact that we can hear a direct and true and profound teaching and have an affinity towards it and even have insight into it and still be caught should give us some indication of the truth of what Dada Roshi is saying here. And yet, it's still important to ask the question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? Of trying to find ways to turn towards. So Chinkwan said, it's just like this. And it's this that you are sitting in the midst of in every moment, that you are directing your mind towards, that you are never apart from. It can never be lost, and that means you can't lose it. It's never at a distance. It means you are never distant from it. In other words, it can never be lost. It's not true in the abstract. It's true for you. It's true for me. It's true for every living being. It just can't be directly experienced through words and ideas. Though words and ideas can help guide us. And so we take this seat. So when Bodhidharma purportedly said it's a special transmission, this way, this direct path is a special transmission beyond sutras. As profound as they are, they cannot convey it, they cannot give it, with no reliance on words and letters. A direct pointing to mind and the realization of Buddha. And so it comes down to this direct pointing. What is the direct pointing? The great way has no side roads. So that means we have to walk a path that has no side roads. You know, I've often had the image of commitment that comes out of faith in the Dharma as the difference between walking down a hallway, right, as you walk along your path that is filled with doors. And as you walk down that hallway, every door is open. And as you pass by, there's something really cool going on inside. Right? Every single one. Sometimes it's cool because it's not always cool. Sometimes it's tragic. But it gets your attention. It calls to you. And we might think the commitment is that every door is closed. But that wouldn't be freely given. That wouldn't be freedom. It's just every door is open, but you know what direction you're headed in. And even if you step in, because it's so attractive, it doesn't satisfy for long, because there's a sense already within you of what you're, where you're headed, what your direction is. And then you realize very quickly, this is not satisfying that. This is not helping. And so we sit. So we have to walk a path that has no side roads, or we have to learn how to bring every single side road onto the path. They're pretty much the same. Because all things abide in their own perfect Dharma state. Because the distraction or the suffering or the high or low, the obstruction, is never in the thing. Whatever that might be, it's never in that room. It comes down to how do we perceive things? How do we see things? How do we experience things? How do we understand things in such a way that our basic, deepest impulse to be free and generous and loving and awake and to live a full and meaningful life, how does that get thwarted? Everyone goes down side roads. You know, it doesn't take much skill at all to get lost, right? Everybody gets lost, whether it's lost for a moment or a day or a year or 10 years. The challenge is to find our way back. But understanding that each thing abides in its own Dharma state is another way of saying you're fine. Things are fine. Your senses are fine. When your senses come into contact with the world, that's fine. So what's happening? Where does it go, seem to go astray? Ching Kuan said, it's just like this. The essential matter. But the student asked further, well, what do you have to teach these days? Apparently, having missed. That Qingyuan just completely emptied his pantry. So the student wants to know, well, what else you got? Still hungry. Qingyuan says, come closer. And so he steps closer, and Qingyuan says, now, keep this in mind. And the footnote to that, Dada Roshi says, this instruction may be difficult for this student, which is another way of saying it's not as it appears. As you know, we'll be studying the Lotus Sutra and the theme of Arango's faith in Buddha nature. And there's a, Dogen was very, apparently very fond of the Lotus Sutra. He spoke of it a lot. He referred to it a lot. He drew upon it a lot in his own teachings. And there's a fascicle in the Shobogenzo where he brings it up a lot. It's Dharma Blossoms Turn Dharma Blossoms. And in that, he tells this story. He said there was a student called Fada who visited the assembly of Huenung. And he bragged that he had chanted the Lotus Sutra 3,000 times. And so Huenung said to him, even if you chanted the sutra 10,000 times, if you don't understand the meaning of it, you won't even know your own mistakes. So Vada said, well, I am actually deluded, so I've only been able to follow the words. How can I understand the meaning? And Huenung said, well, chant it for me, and I'll elucidate the meaning for you. And so Vada started to chant it. And in the second chapter on skillful means, Huenung said, stop. He said, the essential meaning of the sutra is the causes of the Buddha's emergence into the world. There are many parables that are expounded, but there's nothing more than this. This cause is the essential single matter. What is the single essential matter? It is the Buddha unfolding wisdom and entering realization. You are originally Buddha wisdom. You who have this wisdom are a Buddha. You should trust right now that the Buddha wisdom is your own mind. Have faith in Buddha nature. And then he went on to offer a verse, Huenung. He said, when your mind is deluded, you're turned by the Dharma blossoms. When your mind is enlightened, you turn to Dharma blossoms. If you struggle to clarify the meaning after chanting the sutra at length, it will seem to be in opposition. Thinking beyond thinking is skillful. Thinking about thinking is not so skillful. If thinking and beyond thinking do not divide the mind, then you can steer the white ox cart endlessly. And those of you already familiar with the Lotus Sutra know that the parable that he's referring to. If you don't, then you should come to Armando's and find out. When your mind is deluded, you are turned by the blossoms. When your mind is enlightened, you turn the Dharma blossoms. Remember that samsara means to turn, to spin, to go repeatedly over and over through these cycles that we all have experienced in our lives. Bodhidharma said it this way, when you understand, reality turns on you. When you don't understand, you turn on reality. When reality turns on you, then that which isn't real, that which appears to not be real, is now seen as real. That which appeared as false now is seen as real. When you turn reality, that which is real becomes false. When you turn on reality, everything is false. Everything appears untrue. Nothing is ultimately trustworthy. When reality turns on you, everything is true. There is no deception. And so if we think about being caught in our own patterns and cycles, the patterns and cycles of others, words, actions, beliefs, views, how we get turned, somebody says something and we get tripped. I remember years ago, I was invited to one of our students, was a school counselor at a high school in New York. And he wanted to address sexism, misogyny, violence against women within these young students, high school students, teenagers. And so he was working with a group of young men, and he wanted me to come and offer meditation instruction and talk a little bit about the Dharma. And there was one young fellow who was very fortified, very protected, very tough, and nothing was penetrating. And at one point, I don't remember exactly the context, but one of his friends, he was basically saying, nothing gets to me, you know. Nothing turns me. And his friend said, are you kidding? He said, I can turn you on a dime. And he said, no, you can't. And then he said something, and his friend went, ah. He knew just how to, like, get under his skin. I thought it was brilliant. You are originally Buddha wisdom. You who have this wisdom are a Buddha. You should trust right now that this Buddha wisdom is your own mind. Now, of course, Huainong is saying this. Dogen is recounting this because we doubt. 2,500 years ago, 13th century Japan, we doubt that, right? Because the evidence seems to point to something contrary. If that's true, then why all of this? And so that encouragement, trust this. Trust that this is your mind. And so Jingguan says, come closer. Why is that difficult? Tadaroshi used to talk a lot about intimacy. And he was talking about the ultimate intimacy of selflessness, of letting go of all sense of distance, of duality. Why is that coming closer, if we think of it as vulnerability? Why is that so difficult? Well, we've all been hurt, everyone. We've all experienced disappointment. At times we felt betrayed in all manner of ways. And so from very early on, we've learned we're built to survive, right? Every living thing, if it's still living, if it still exists, if it has a lineage, it has learned to survive. And it has created strategies to do that, which are amazing. In every form of life, it's amazing how all living things have learned how to survive within their environment. And so we develop strategies. We learn how to buffer, we learn how to distance, we learn how to fortify, to protect. We might learn by putting ourselves forth, being assertive, being aggressive. We might learn by retreating. We might learn by distracting. But all of this ultimately is, while it protects us when we have little other resources, particularly as we're young, ultimately it doesn't stops working. And it really becomes a distraction from the essential matter. And so thus, in practice, we have to deal with that which is distracting us. Distraction is not just, messing up our mindfulness. It's not just that it's, not allowing us to have a concentrated mind. It's actually distracting us from what we need to see. It's distracting us from what we need to experience directly and intimately. We're going to be working in the art practice with stories, and in working together with this with Hojin Sensei and Shoan as we were drafting it, I said, we talk an awful lot in Dharma practice about letting go of stories, right? About how compelling our stories are, and we all have stories and love them and we tell them over and over and over again. And so like now we're going to ask every student to like spend the ongo telling stories. So we have to make it very clear how this is, how this is connected to, how this is to make this a practice. Thinking about vulnerability and how difficult it is to make ourselves vulnerable. As Brené Brown says, it's what everybody wants. We really respond to it when we see it within another person, but we don't want to do that ourselves. And I looked it up in the dictionary, and lo and behold, the Latin root means to wound. And synonyms, and it means to be susceptible to harm. And synonyms like danger, at risk, unsafe, unprotected. Right? Just a litany of places you don't want to be. And so it makes sense that when we hear that word or consider that, that it's like, no, what? But going on into the definitions, there was exposed, wide, open, undefended, unfortified, unarmed, to let our skin fall off, to let our ego relax, to let our defenses. And that's why it's important in practice. You know, if we stand any chance of really having that trust amidst others and in the world, to train in that and sort of overcome or sort of work through that natural sort of resistance or disinclination to allow ourselves to be exposed, which is Zazen in its essence, then we have to do that in a time and place where we feel like that's going to be safe, right? So we have two people, guardians, in the back of the Zenda who are specifically assigned to watch your back, right? There's a sound, you don't have to worry about it. They've got it. It's something we do for and with each other, right? That's part of the virtue of harmony, is learning how to practice together harmoniously so that we can trust being here with each other. And of course, that's an ongoing piece of work, right? And we all come in with different levels already of trust and distrust. And we learn that, in a way, rightly, through all kinds of experiences, based on who we are, how we show up in the world, our identities, how the world responds to those identities, the meanings that have been assigned, the actual experiences we've had. And so it takes time for that to develop, because you can't force it. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to trust profoundly. It doesn't work like that. We have to learn, and it's not just a mental thing. It's like the whole system has to experience trust. That's what we talk about, faith, practice, and verification. We just have to have enough faith to arrive and then to turn and begin. And then based in that, we begin to have experiences that hopefully confirm that faith. And in that, then the whole system starts to relax. It's like, oh, okay, that was okay. And that then gives us confidence to have more faith. And then on the basis of that, we practice more deeply, with more exposure. And then we realize, hopefully, oh, that was okay. And on it goes. I was, Jimon showed me this clip from the war in Ukraine. I'm just assuming it's credible. If it's a piece of propaganda on the part of the Ukrainians, I applaud it because it's very effective. If it's propaganda to protect life, versus propaganda to destroy life. But it was just shot on the phone, and it was a soldier, a Russian soldier. I don't know if he'd run out of gas or lost his way or had been captured, but he was surrounded just by some Ukrainian townspeople. And one of the women had gone into her house and brought him a cup of tea and something to eat. And he was sobbing. I could only think because of the fact of what he was in the middle of, that he had very little control over. And the fact that here he was surrounded by the enemy and they were taking care of him. What does he do with that? And then she says to him, do you have a phone? And he said, yes. And she says, call your mother. Call her and tell her you're okay. And so he does. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Dogen says to take refuge in the three treasures, whether at the time of the Buddha or after the Buddha's parinirvana, fill yourself with pure trust. Put your hands together, bow, and say, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Fill yourself with pure trust. Now, of course, that's an aspiration, pure trust, to be completely trusting. I think that must only come through time. But I hope that every one of you have seen trust and faith grow within you and have been encouraged by that, affirmed by that, have gained confidence in that, believe in that. And that you see more and more that that faith in the Dharma is really faith in yourself. That's really what you're having faith in. The Dharma, having faith in the Dharma, allows us to take this wisdom teaching and translate it, in a sense, from concept into direct experience. That's what we call practice. Practice is like a translation of a teaching. How do you take a teaching and turn it and transform it into something embodied? I mean, that's the essential thing, right? And so if you really think of practice as that, it's sort of, it's the manifest, living manifestation in your own body and mind of the teachings. And so that faith in the Dharma really allows us to bring that into our own body and mind, into what we call practice. And lo and behold, suddenly, you trust yourself. It's not the Dharma as though it's something outside, although that faith in the Dharma is growing because we see that, those teachings translated into practice, translated into our living experience, brings us closer. So Qingquan says, come closer. The student steps closer and Qingquan says, now, keep this in mind. And I would say, come closer without moving. Keep this in mind without a thought. We could think of that as remembering, right? Just like we have to remember to practice, remember to be silent, remember to be mindful, remember to sit, to not forget. And so we develop skills that help us to remember. And that's important and fine. And in a way, it brings us closer to practice. And we could say that brings us closer to the Dharma, closer to ourselves. But Qingquan is speaking at another level. Keep this in mind. The three worlds are never apart from mind. The three worlds are mind, are in mind. Mind is the three worlds, which is the whole catastrophe, as Dada Roshi loved to say. So when we think, when the teachings point to how we seek outside, you know, the putting a head on top of the one you already have. If you meet the Buddha, if you meet the Buddha outside of yourself, kill the Buddha. That is, don't give that life. It's outside. In a way, we can understand all of those, the many ways we do that, as in that moment, not trusting ourselves on a basic level, which is fine. It's not a crime. It's not a sign of insincerity. It's something we have learned, and probably for very good reason, so we can survive. You know, why is it that we have such a strong inclination towards the negative? You know, we had a someone in residence last year who is a psychiatrist, but also done a lot of work in neuroscience, and we did a Mondo together. And he talked about that, and I asked him that, and he said he thought it was survival. You know, that we need to be particularly attentive to anything that would be threatening our life, right? And so we've developed this very high alert antenna, right, to keep us safe. But the problem is when we are safe, we can't let it rest. And that it becomes liberally applied to everything. It's not really no longer about our survival, although we could say it might be about the survival of the ego. And so we respond to things that are a criticism, pointing something out. And we actually perceive it as a threat to our existence. And so we sit on this seat, this sacred mountain form, and occupy this seat of enlightenment. And we do that in the midst of clear skies and stormy skies, in every season, in every weather pattern, in hell realms, in heavenly realms, in boredom realms, right? In I can't do it realms, in I am the hero realms, all kinds of realms. And the challenge is not only to not move away, but it's to keep our eyes and our hearts and our body open and exposed, to let it in, because it's already in. Now, we gain power because we are no longer being turned by that moment, but we are learning how to turn this, which before we called an obstruction or an affliction or my suffering or a headache, or an obstacle. Now it's being turned into awakening, into letting go, into insight, into confidence, into patience. You know, it's kind of like if when we all came in, each in our own time, if there was somebody at the door who said, look, warning, it's going to seem to get harder before it gets better. That's called healing. That's what healing looks like. And in a way, the more fully we heal, the more the pain is all over the body. Because the world is still the world. And as we see samsara more and more clearly, it's so much more painful. Because as we see how worlds upon worlds upon worlds are built on illusions and ideas, things that have no actual substance, things that have no reality, they don't live anywhere except in our minds, and we make them real, and we fight and kill for them. And we hold on to them with passion. And all to our own detriment and the detriment of others. And when we see how powerful and impactful we can be within our delusion, it's heartbreaking. But to know that each and every person contains Buddha wisdom. And in a sense, when we see somebody acting against that, the more and more they act against it is just an expression of the further and further away from that faith, that trust, that possibility, the more distant it seems. But because it's never distant, the possibility of a shift, of an opening, of a change, of light getting through is always there. And that's where the bodhisattva works. That's why the teachings speak about the fearlessness of the bodhisattva. That the bodhisattva is not discouraged by how much suffering there is, by how many beings are in pain, by how long it takes. Because they've seen all of that. They've gone through it. They've lived it. They live in the midst of it. But because they have done all of those things, they've also seen that it's empty of anything fixed. Nothing is determined in advance. Nothing is unworkable. Revolutions are always just a hair's breadth away. When you turn reality, that which is real seems to be false, when that which is false now is seen as real, rather. We can see Buddha nature in every person. And it's really just our misguided misuse of that basic impulse to be alive, to have happiness, to be fulfilled, how upside down that can become. The bright, shining sun lights up the sky. The pure, whispering wind covers the earth. Practice, I don't know. I'm sure there are 100,000 ways to gain faith in this world, in each other, in ourselves. Personally, I have never encountered anything that is more powerful than practice and zazen, in bringing forth that faith, because it's not an idea. It's a living thing. It happens without you even knowing it. I've watched it happen without a person even wanting it. I've watched people, like some of our Sangha members in prison, who were deeply committed to not being vulnerable, not seemingly a good idea in prison, become vulnerable. And so how fortunate are we? And so let's really, you know, the important thing about Sesshin is to practice beyond time. On the one hand, to know that it's fleeting so that you're not wasting it, but not to sit in time so that the experience becomes vast, unbounded, not dependent, because that's really training us to practice steadily, with constancy. That it doesn't begin with the beginning of session, it doesn't end with the end of session, it's continuity. It just keeps changing form. And so to sit all the way through this day as though it's the first, it's the last, it's just this.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.